Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Senate confirmation hearing of Donald Trump's choice for the next Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, and speak with Syed Kashani, a lawyer whose clients have included the largest home builders in California. He has litigated extensively against One West Bank and its former owner, Steve Mnuchin. We'll discuss the numerous documents involving private agreements between the government and the owners of One West Syed acquired through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act, some of which were passed on to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who asked pointed questions of the nominee, who appears to have gotten rich by evicting people from their homes using fraudulent robo-signing documents to foreclose on 36,000 family homes using what was described today as a foreclosure machine. Then we'll look into the systemic fraud in the aftermath of the housing crisis that Steve Mnuchin was able to capitalize on and speak with William K. Black, distinguished scholar in research for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of law and economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, he joins us to discuss how Mnuchin ran what is aptly called a vulture fund, which enabled Mnuchin and his partners to profit from the misery of Americans who were defrauded by liar's loans and lost their homes when the housing market collapsed, a financial crisis that allowed One West to swoop in and foreclose on the homeowners using fraudulent documents that opened up government coffers to reward Mnuchin and make him rich. Then finally, ahead of Saturday's Women's March in Washington and across the country and around the world, we will look into the fake news disseminated by Fox News's Greta Van Susteren, now on MSNBC, and others that perpetuate the myth that Donald Trump won the women's vote in the last election over Hillary Clinton. Kelly Dittmar, a professor of political science and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss how this fake news, along with Trump's repeated claim that he won a landslide, flies in the face of the real statistics that show Hillary Clinton won 54% of the women's vote to Donald Trump's 42%. And joining us now is Syed Kashani, who has practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm Shearman & Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin. He has acquired numerous private agreements between the government and the owners of One West through court orders and the Freedom of Information Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Syed Kashani.
Thank you, and good to be back.
Well, thank you. And last time you were here, we got an awful lot of response because you were somebody that actually knew about what happened with One West Bank and its foreclosures, which have led to some people talking about Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury nominee of Donald Trump's, as being the foreclosure king. In broad strokes, it does look as if Steven Mnuchin got rich by evicting people from their homes, which is an appalling idea. He, of course, defended himself and said that since I was first nominated to serve as Secretary of Treasury, I have been maligned as taking advantage of others' hardships in order to earn a buck. Nothing could be further from the truth. Do you believe what he just said? Because the evidence that you provided us the last time we talked would indicate that he did profit from the misery of others.
Well, Mr. Mnuchin is trying to defend himself, but he has a case that cannot be defended. Not only did Steve Mnuchin make millions or maybe tens of millions of dollars personally, over $1 billion for his partners at Goldman Sachs and in this investment, not only did he make all of those millions from foreclosing on thousands of families, the other point is that he made all that money through a government subsidy. And the most laughable part about his nomination is that he's sitting there talking about free enterprise and how we have to get government off people's backs and end regulation, when he made his money from a government subsidy program that rewarded him and his investors for foreclosing. And that's the structure that I described in our last interview, and I can summarize again if you wish.
Well, let's stick with the today's hearing, because it was, you know, the Democrats were on the offensive about the very issue we're talking about. I think it not just goes to the fact that this man, you know, well, not just his financial past, but maybe his moral standing. But the material that you got in Discovery and the Freedom of Information Act about what went on with One West Bank, where they kicked about 36,000 people out of their homes with this robo-signing, which should be illegal under any reasonable measure. That's fraud. So there's a lot there. But I take it that a lot of this material you sent to Senator Elizabeth Warren, because she seemed to be on top of it in her questioning today.
I forwarded to Senator Warren, who's a former professor at Harvard Law School, where I attended, as much information as I could publicly disclose. Some of the material we get in litigation is subject to privacy and protective orders, but I forwarded to her as much public information as I could in a summary, and I'm glad to see that some of it was put to good use.
Well, on top of the history with One West Bank, Mnuchin apparently failed to disclose nearly $100 million of his assets to the Senate Finance Committee in the disclosure documents that they require. And apparently he just said he forgot to mention his role as a director of an investment fund located in the tax havens of Anguilla and the Cayman Islands.
Well, that's par for the course. I mean, you know, Mr. Mnuchin and his partners specialize not only in making money off government contracts, government subsidy, but they also specialize in not paying any of that money to the government in taxes. So you would expect that someone who makes his money from a contract with government subsidies is going to be equally careful about not paying any of his money back in taxes. And that's where the Cayman Islands come in. There's only one reason to set up these funds in the Cayman, and that's to avoid U.S. tax.
Well, actually, I was incorrect in as much as Mnuchin. This $100 million that he failed to disclose was not Anguilla, but it was from a Dune Capital International, which is an investment fund in the movies that invested in, for example, Avatar, which was obviously a successful film. It was from Dune Capital International, and that was incorporated in the Cayman Islands, and that was the $100 million that he forgot to mention. For purposes of disclosure, an old friend of mine ran that company, but and nevertheless, that seems like a pretty major, oh, I forgot I had $100 million in the Cayman Islands.
Well, you know, you mentioned the movie business. It's worth adding here that what's coming out in these hearings, and was also previously known, is that Mnuchin himself personally invested in some movie projects, some of which did okay and many of which failed. But he had his bank, One West Bank, while Mnuchin was running One West Bank, Mnuchin had One West Bank make large loans to the same companies that Mnuchin was personally investing in. So I don't know why that's not a conflict of interest, and that came out tangentially in these hearings as well. Again, it's all part of the same course. It's the what these Wall Street banks specialize in is not private enterprise or free enterprise. What they specialize in is utilizing and exploiting government subsidy, government money, government help in order to make private profit. That's what Wall Street has come to today.
The BBC story on this, let me read you the last paragraph of the story, because to me it does sum it up, say it. But Democratic senators seem determined to make sure that anyone following Steve Mnuchin's confirmation understands that far from being part of a populist movement to reform and remake the U.S. economy, Mr. Mnuchin has so far been at the heart of a financial system which enriches the elite and hurts the common people. And to my mind, that's what this massive scam and fraud known as Donald Trump is all about. The country is going to be scammed. This is a man who ran for president promising to help working Americans in the middle class and make America great again. And it's obvious from the people he's chosen that he's going to make him and his buddies rich again. That's what it's about.
Well, I don't have expertise to speak about Donald Trump as a whole. But I can say that as to Steve Mnuchin, who was the former head of One West Bank, that he made his money from a combination of foreclosing on thousands of people and getting a government subsidy and a reward for every foreclosure. Let me take two points that came up in the hearings that I think are important. Senator Dean Heller from Nevada asked Steve Mnuchin a simple question, which is, how many families did you foreclose on in Nevada? How many loan modifications, if any, did you make in Nevada? How many loans did you have in Nevada? Mnuchin claimed he couldn't answer any of those questions, and he would have to check and get back. Senator Heller pointed out that he had previously asked Mnuchin these questions 7 times, orally, in person, and in writing, and Mnuchin still will not provide the answer. And the answer, the reason is obvious, is obviously tens of thousands of families that he foreclosed on in Nevada and in Arizona, not to mention California. And that's why Steve Mnuchin won't give that answer. So, you know, right there we see. Now, another thing was said, very wrong, very laughable. Senator Kimmy, I believe, stated that a bank normally prefers to work out a loan and modify it and not foreclose. And Mnuchin very piously said, yes, we lose money on foreclosures. That is a completely false statement. Because of the subsidy agreement that Mnuchin and his partners made with the government, they were rewarded with government money for every loss they had on a foreclosure. The deal they had is when they foreclosed on a house and the bank lost money, which banks do lose money on a house foreclosure, the government would reimburse that loss and more. So it's completely false for Mnuchin to say we lost money on foreclosures. They made money on every foreclosure, and that's why they were so eager to foreclose. And that's where all the robo-signing and all the chicanery that they utilized to foreclose on houses came in. When you're being rewarded through your contract with a government subsidy for foreclosing on people, obviously the bank's incentive and what they did was to foreclose as fast and as often as they could. I think the only hope in these proceedings is I'm hoping some of these Republican senators, like Republican Heller, Senator Heller from Nevada, will step up and vote against this nomination. Because this nomination, I think, is really not consistent with anything that Donald Trump told the American people during the election.
But let's talk about robo-signing, because on the surface, I cannot understand how it could be anything but highly illegal that you, Steve Mnuchin, through One West Bank, hires a bunch of people to commit white-collar crime. They literally retroactively create documents that favor them and hurt the homeowner that they're about to evict. Am I correct?
Well, I'll do you one better. I'll do you one better. The Office of Thrift Supervision, in their investigation of One West Bank, while it was run by Mnuchin, found that in some cases, the One West employees signed documents claiming to own loans, claiming that loans were owned by One West Bank and they had the right to foreclose, when in fact they had no documentation that they actually owned that loan. What does that mean? They were foreclosing on loans they had no right to foreclose on. They did not even own the loan and they were still foreclosing. This was their eagerness to foreclose, get the government subsidy, make the money. And one thing that came up in the hearings is how much of the profit to One West Bank came from government subsidy, and that question was asked. It hasn't been answered, but at least one of the senators did ask that question. As far as why it's not illegal, I don't know. It seems that these practices become so widespread that the regulators either accept them or don't bring any charges or don't take any action. In the entire loan scandal, this whole scandal in California, for example, I only know of 2 or 3 indictments that were returned against bankers. 2 out of 1 failed bank in Riverside, and 1 lady out of Missoula's, a countrywide operation. Of the thousands of people involved in this process, why only 2 or 3 are indicted, I simply cannot explain. And there's no justification for that. Every act of robo-signing is an act of fraud. It's illegal, and it should be investigated and, if appropriate, charges filed. But I personally don't know of any cases where charges were filed as a result of robo-signing.
But just on the surface, it would seem that if you or I, Syed Kashani, if you or I furnished fraudulent documents to a bank in order to get a loan, and they finally found out that we were conning them, we'd probably end up in jail or at least be fined. I mean, I can't understand the double standard. If a bank does it, it's okay, but if an individual does it, it's a crime.
Well, on the one hand, you could say the old adage, too big to fail, too big to jail, but yeah. This operated at all levels. One West was not one of the larger banks, but nonetheless, there were no actions brought there. Even after the Office of Thrift Supervision found all these violations in robo-signing, no criminal charges were filed, and I personally cannot explain that. I don't know why that was the case. I think it's a travesty. You know, it operates in some ways like a third world country, but it's unacceptable for this day and age and the United States legal system.
So what do we know? I mean, Steve Mnuchin has a kind of trophy wife there, for this Scottish model who's sporting these massive diamond rings, etc. And he now flies around in jets. It's almost like he's a Trump wannabe. And so many of the people that Trump has chosen, like this Secretary of Education, who clearly doesn't know a damn thing about education, she's a billionaire. That's her qualification. Wilbur Ross is a billionaire. Is this like a billionaires club that we're talking about here? Because I don't detect that any of these people that are in this cabinet, they're getting paid back for political favors. Mnuchin ran Trump's finance committee. Sessions, the senator, was the first and only senator to support Trump. The same with the energy secretary, Governor Perry. He was the first of the rivals to endorse Trump, and then followed by the other fellow at HUD, Dr. Ben Carson. This all seems, and I'm not suggesting that Democrats haven't put their buddies in. Bill Clinton put his buddy from Arkansas in as the attorney general. He never even made it. I know it's a political process, but this does feel like, you know, a bunch of billionaires being paid back for being nice to Donald.
Well, I'm not here to talk about wives and families and net worth. I don't have the information about some of these other nominees. But I can say about Steve Mnuchin personally, without regard to his family, that Steve Mnuchin personally made his money and is sitting in the chair he is today through a government largesse, government subsidy program that he entered into with the government over this failed bank, through which he profited through government money by foreclosing on thousands of families. To my mind, that disqualifies someone from being the Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, what exactly do they expect him to do? Go into the Treasury and start handing out these same deals to his other buddies at Goldman Sachs? It's the fox in charge of the chicken coop. It's ridiculous. It's the fox who's already slaughtered half of the chickens, and now you're going to put him in charge of the coop so he can slaughter the other half.
Well, it's a bit strange, though, that Donald Trump was blackballed by Goldman Sachs because of his many bankruptcies, and he couldn't raise capital on Wall Street. But then he turns around and hires a bunch of Goldman Sachs people. It feels like his way of of getting revenge. I mean, you know, he did. I know I keep asking you these political questions, and it's probably unfair, but you know, he did. Remember, he toyed with the former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. He toyed with him, dangling the Secretary of State's job like a cat toys with a wounded bird, you know. It just, again, I wonder about how much psychology is involved in these choices from the point of view of Trump's own personal agenda as opposed to whether these people are competent.
I can't speak to psychology. I can speak to this one nominee, and I can say that Steve Mnuchin is everything that Donald Trump campaigned against. Donald Trump campaigned against cronyism, inside deals, government subsidies, and Steve Mnuchin is the king of inside deals, government subsidies, and what you might call cronyism, in the sense that he brought his buddies along for this deal. So this nominee is completely inconsistent with everything Donald Trump promised the American people. And you know what's ironic is I bet a large number of people foreclosed by Steve Mnuchin voted for Donald Trump, hoping that Trump would bring some change. And the change he's bringing is to bring the guy who foreclosed on them and make him head of the Treasury.
So just in closing, what does that mean going forward, though? What's going to happen with the Treasury? Is the trough going to be opened to these same buddies?
Well, I mean, Steve Mnuchin would find it hard to resist giving the same deal he got to others of his buddies the next time the chance comes along. I mean, what's good for him is good for his buddies, one would think. So at a minimum, you would see that when a failed bank comes along or when this kind of government opportunity comes along, he's going to be giving it to his friends, just as he took advantage before. But you could see it go much further and get much worse. For example, he might start a process of privatizing government treasury auctions to a greater extent, or letting private investment companies or investment houses at the Social Security funds, a partial privatization of Social Security. These are the types of things that you would expect him to do. Because, as I said before, his Mnuchin's objective, Wall Street's objective, is not to make money from free enterprise, individual effort, and private capital. Their objective, as shown by Mnuchin's operation of One West Bank, is to use government money, government subsidy, to make private profit. And when you put that gentleman in charge of the Treasury, you're just opening the floodgates and creating many more opportunities for this thing to happen again and again and again. And the people who will suffer are, as always, the small homeowners, the small businesses, the people who get foreclosed out. That's what the future holds, possibly, if they confirm this nomination. I would just like to end on one hopeful note. I do hope that at least two of the Republican senators vote against this nomination, and these are the senators from Nevada and Arizona. I mean, their states suffered very heavily from the foreclosure crisis, and I think any senator from those states who votes in favor of this nominee should be turned out at the next election.
Well, Syed Kashani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No problem. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Syed Kashani, who's practiced law in California since 1989, including with the preeminent Los Angeles firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, and later with the Wall Street firm of Shearman & Sterling. His clients have included the largest private home builders in California, and he's litigated extensively against One West Bank, owned by Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the systemic fraud in the aftermath of the housing crisis that Steve Mnuchin was able to capitalize on.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William K. Black, a distinguished scholar in residence for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Yeah, white-collar criminologist, he is the founding member of Bank Whistleblowers United and the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He has an article at The Dollar and Cents, The New Democrats' Addiction to Austerity Will Not Die. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Well, the hearings today of Steve Mnuchin to become the next Secretary of the Treasury, some of the Democrats did go after him on the basis of his record, which does appears to be, simply put, that this man got rich off evicting Americans from their homes. And he, of course, denied that and said he's been maligned. But the evidence that I've heard so far and that Elizabeth Warren and others have put forth would indicate that that's absolutely how he got rich. And by the way, These were government subsidies he got riched off. And the way that he got the government money was through robo-signing, which under any reasonable measure should be against the law. It's fraud.
So to back it up a step, this all comes from IndyMac. And IndyMac was a savings and loan that specialized in making fraudulent liar's loans. And IndyMac, the industry's own fraud experts, found that the incidence of fraud in liar's loans was 90%. And the investigators, Tom Miller in particular, the Iowa Attorney General, who led many of these investigations, testified to the Federal Reserve that these frauds in inflating the borrower's income typically came from the lenders and their agents, not the homeowners. So that's the first level fraud. The second level fraud is that you also predated upon particular minority groups, particularly Latinos and blacks, and you charged people more secret. Well, you told them you were getting the best deal, and in fact, you looked for one of the worst deals on interest rates because that paid you, as the loan broker, a yield spread premium. So again, you get this bonus the more you betray the person across the desk from you who thinks that you're working on their behalf because you've told them that you're working on their behalf. So that was the second stage fraud. As a result of this, people were, then there was appraisal fraud. That was the third level of fraud, again, by the lenders and their agents. As a result of this, many people are losing their homes. IndyMac fails, but not before the industry, the entire mortgage banking industry, chose as its spokesperson before the Federal Reserve in the hearings in San Francisco on should we do something about these liar's loans, the people from IndyMac to be the industry spokesperson saying as an industry position, no, we want to be able to do these fraudulent loans, even though we know the fraud incidence is 90%. All right, so then IndyMac fails, of course, as a result of all these frauds. The senior managers are left rich, and the vulture funds come in. And Mnuchin runs, the way he got rich is from what the trade calls running a vulture fund. And you are then correct. Then there's not unique in any way, by the way, to IndyMac, the national practice. There are a whole series of frauds, and Diane's new book goes through many examples of these. It's not a single fraud, and robo-signing is the name that people remember, but it's misleading. It's not that they had some machine signing people's, the lenders or whoever owned the mortgages name. It's that to be able to do a foreclosure, it varies by state, but in almost all states, you have to file an affidavit that says, I've looked at the following, and it can be 12 to 20 things, and I can personally attest and do so attest under penalty of perjury that each of these factors is present. And the Justice Department did not stop that. And that's what Diane's new book, in part, is about. It was individual victims working with teeny tiny law firms that actually did depositions, some of which you can, I think, still find on YouTube, in which the witnesses admit that as to every one of those 12 to 20 representations, every single one of them was a lie.
Yeah, but who was organizing this, Bill? Who was paying them? Who organized the robo-signing? Because they were basically backfilling paperwork in order to get the foreclosure and the government money, weren't they?
Well, again, there are many different frauds in this. Some of them involved getting the various government HAMP and HARP programs money. Others do not. It was far broader than ones that you would get HAMP and HARP, because those programs were, after all, grossly inadequate in size. And it was many different kinds of fraud. I'm describing one. My personal favorite is when you do a document that's going to have mass usage, and you have to change a particular, you know, have to basically fill in a blank with, say, somebody's name. You create a placeholder, right? And it typically goes brackets, name of mortgagee here, close brackets, right? But what they discovered, and they were actually filed in court and actually led to the foreclosures, led to people losing their homes, is there was this really sleazy company that developed to run the a number of aspects of these frauds. And their placeholder was bogus assignee.
Bogus what?
Bogus assignee. Now, assignee is just a Latin thing for who's assigned the mortgage. Mm-hmm. As your listeners will know, your mortgage is almost always sold for the servicing rights to somebody other than who originally did the mortgage. And so it can be perfectly fine. You can sell the mortgage, do an assignment. But these people, as their placeholder, used brackets, bogus assignee, close brackets.
Good Lord. And they got away with it.
And they got away with it for years, and almost nobody went to jail for it. The Justice Department refused to prosecute in these things, as with so many others. So IndyMac is simply one of many, except that IndyMac, the folks come in specifically to take advantage.
And that's Mnuchin. So let's go straight to that then. IndyMac fails. The top guys get the golden parachutes. He's a vulture capitalist. He moves in, and then he creates One West Bank. Is that what happened?
Yes. And then they get, as you say, lots of governmental money, and they're part of this whole process, except they're known for being more aggressive than others in forcing people into foreclosure. So, you know, this is just a typical awful vulture, you know, somebody that tries to get rich off of human suffering. And therefore, of course, a perfect representative of the new president of the United States to run Treasury and make sure that nobody comes after these folks, because the statute of limitations has not run on a lot of Mnuchin stuff.
So will this man then, as Secretary of the Treasury, and by the way, he got some tough questions from Democrats, but he also got tough questions from Senator Heller, a Republican from Nevada, where an awful lot of people were kicked out of their homes, and he didn't answer Heller's question. He's asking many times to give how many people were kicked out of their homes in both Arizona and in Nevada, not to mention California. And apparently Mnuchin has never provided a figure.
Yeah, and for your listeners in particular, IndyMac concentrated in the West, particularly in California, but as you say, also in Arizona, Nevada. So there are enough people who were victimized to create a critical mass that obviously I would think have made some calls to their congressman. And this is one of those demonstrations. Even if your congressman is from an opposing party and no great protector of the people in general, if enough people suffer losses in his district and they get mad and they call and write him or her, they actually will periodically ask tough questions. And in general, there are a number of good exceptions, but in general, the Democratic questioning, I would say, of the Trump nominees has been quite weak.
Well, that may be because the Democratic Party itself appears to be quite weak and doesn't seem to have an idea of what happened to them and why they lost an election that they actually won by 3 million votes. And, you know, there's just on Wednesday at George Washington University, all of the candidates who want to be the next chair of the Democratic National Committee put themselves on display. And the last thing any of them wanted to talk about was the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, the grassroots anger on the Democratic side and on the political left in this country. And it was as though the Sanders revolution never happened. They didn't want to talk about it. They just wanted to put out, you know, sort of bland statements about unity and vague calls for maybe we need to organize better and all this kind of stuff. So if you're looking for an opposition in this country to the most outrageous political accident in American history, where we may end up with an authoritarian leader who's clueless and incredibly dangerous, you'd think that the opposition in this country would be organizing at warp speed.
Well, to continue the theme that people aren't helpless, but it does require getting very upset and acting. The title of David Diane's book that I referred to is Chain of Title, but after the colon, the title is How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And, you know, it wasn't just those three, but it is true that those three folks are indeed, you know, just sort of normal Americans, and they did play really valuable roles in bringing down some of these fraud variants. It's going to take that, I agree, the whole group of New Democrats, as they call themselves, they arose in explicit opposition to the Democratic Party, as it had been since FDR. And they explicitly were hostile in many ways to the working class, and they've been waging what I call the Long War for over 35 years. And famously, President Obama went in front of the New Democrats caucus at the start of his term and said, you know, you folks represent my views about how to do things. So those views include being really, really, really protective of Wall Street, hence the lack of prosecutions, and being very much for what enriches Wall Street, which is austerity. Austerity causes the, you know, U.S. recovery to be nowhere near as strong and nowhere near as fast. It is a great enemy of the working class. It's in large part the reason that for now over 35 years, essentially, there have been no gains by normal Americans, and why there's been off-the-chart gains. I mean, it's actually a misnomer to talk about the 1%. It's actually the 1/10,000th of the 1% that have reaped the vast bulk of these gains, and they're concentrated in the usual places, but Wall Street and, in particular, these kinds of private equity funds that have spawned these vulture funds all over the world that go from crisis to crisis. So they're very active. Wilbur Ross, for example, is extremely active. He's been made very wealthy by the public funding response to the crisis in Ireland.
Right, but under Donald Trump, we know already that he has promised, and Paul Ryan has promised, to execute massive tax cuts for the very wealthiest Americans, and this will in turn require more austerity because the deficit will go up and they'll all say, oh, the sky is falling, the deficit is huge, and you all have to tighten your belts while we at the very top.
Maybe. When Republican presidents are in office, Republican legislators ever since Reagan have famously risen above what their supposed principles and been enthusiastic runners of the deficits. The deficits, or, you know, the famous phrase is Dick Cheney saying that Ronald Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. It's the Democrats that, in particular, the new Democrats, that even when a Democratic president is in power, and even though it would have made Obama a one-term president, if he had gotten austerity as he wanted, his presidential address, you know, on the State of the Union, in January 2010, think how early that is in his, you know, in his first term, was an ode to austerity and going after basically the working class. It was insane. Had he succeeded, as I said, he would have been a one-term president because he would have crushed the recovery through austerity, sent us back into a double-dip recession, and you know, he would have been toast, and even more Democratic legislators would have lost office under his term, what would have become a single term. So you're right, the Democrats are addicted. That's, you know, hence the name of my piece. And unless they're willing to make a break, and of course this is being fuzzed over under the usual thing, we need unity. Right. So, you know, you can't talk about policy differences. You certainly can't talk about changing policies. And you can't admit that there were any problems under Obama.
Well, but, you know, Trump ran on the idea that this is this huge national debt. That's always a joke, you know. And what Reagan did was he ran up huge deficits because by increasing defense spending and not paying for it, you foreclose on other possible spending on social programs. And that's been the...
Right. So that's what austerity does when the Democrats buy into it.
Right.
Well, it becomes Sophie's Choice.
Right.
Then the Republicans stick back and say, you decide which of your social programs to starve for funds.
Right. Well, let's hope there's some kind of Newton's law here. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction here, because this is an extraordinary situation we're in, and we're crying out for a real political opposition in this country. I thank you for joining us, William Black.
Thank you. And remember, the world as well, because when we unleash these vulture folks, they don't prey just on Americans. They prey on people all over the world.
And again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who's a distinguished scholar in research for financial regulation at the University of Minnesota and a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Saturday's Women's March and the fake news story that Donald Trump won the women's vote when, in fact, Hillary Clinton won the women's vote by 54% compared to Donald Trump's 42%.
Forget about your house of cards, and now they're mine. The infrastructure will collapse from vaulted
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kelly Dittmar, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. She's the author of Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns, as well as multiple book chapters on gender and American politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kelly Dittmar.
Thanks for having me.
There's a kind of canard that's developed about women not supporting Hillary Clinton in this last election. And it's, of course, something worth exploring on the eve of Saturday's march of women, both in Washington, D.C. and many cities around the country as well as around the world. So let's start with this, why there is this impression out there that more women voted for Donald Trump than they did for Hillary Clinton. Vanity Fair had an article, Why Hillary Clinton Couldn't Win Over Female Voters. Time magazine ran a story, Why So Many Women Abandoned Hillary Clinton. Slate had a story, White Women Sold Out the Sisterhood in the World of Voting for Trump, and so on. And then I was watching this Fox woman that moved across to MSNBC, Greta Van Susteren, last night, talking about the march and basically saying, you know, that the problem is that more women voted for Trump. And she cited statistics that said more women voted for Trump. But it's not true. I mean,
not true.
That's, how did this happen? I mean, let's just start with the basic fact. The majority of women in this country backed Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, 54% to 42%. And Greta Van Susteren was reversing those numbers. So is this like Trump and Pence saying they had this huge victory when Hillary Clinton won 3 million more votes?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it demonstrates is a couple of things. One is there was sort of misreporting in terms of focusing almost entirely on white women. So there was a lot of discussion about white women throughout the campaign, a lot of polling done specifically on white women voters and what were they going to do. And the reason why is because they tended to be more of a swing group. In other words, you know, 96% of black women voted for Barack Obama. They were going to vote for the Democratic candidate this time around. And unfortunately, what that meant in terms of media coverage is we spent very little time looking at and talking about particularly black women and women of color, who are an increasingly growing portion of the electorate and, of course, really important voters for Democrats. But we spent too little time, I would argue, talking about those women, spent a lot of time talking about white women. And then what happened, I think, in the reporting out of the election was that the narrative continued to be about white women, and that's where Hillary Clinton lost. I wrote a piece right after the election as well for our project. We did a project called Presidential Gender Watch throughout this cycle. And I wrote a piece pretty quickly because of this false narrative in which the title was, No, Women Didn't Abandon Clinton, Nor Did She Fail to Win Their Support. Hillary Clinton won 54% of women, as you noted. She, the only group of women by race that she didn't win was white women. And even among white women, she won among college-educated white women. She won 51% of that group, compared to Mitt Romney won that group by 6 points in 2012. So she fared better than Barack Obama among college-educated white women, at least when compared to 2012. The group that she lost significantly was non-college-educated white women. And that wasn't a surprise. That's a group that has been voting Republican for many elections past. So not only did she not lose women overall, she also lost a very particular group of women who we should have all expected she would likely lose.
So in other words, what Greta Van Susteren's doing is taking the statistic that Trump won the white women with 53%. And just simply ignoring the overall picture where Hillary Clinton won women over Trump 54% to 42%. I mean, it's just some form of selective bias here that is completely fraudulent. And again, I'm astounded at how many times both Mike Pence and Donald Trump keep repeating they won this massive landslide when Hillary Clinton won 3 million more votes than them. So is that what it comes down to? Is just
this, well, you know, I don't know about the Greta Van Susteren segment. I haven't seen it myself, so I don't know if there was a small footnote, you know, on the graphic. If it's, you know,
No. She kept repeating it. She kept repeating it. She was interviewing an actress who was going to march in the march, Patricia Arquette, who's going to be in this march, and she repeated those statistics many times. Yeah. So that was what was so. That's in fact, that's why I'm calling you, because I wanted to get. It didn't ring true to me, you know.
Yeah. So, no, and I think, look, and, you know, and this is for all of us, for myself as a scholar and advocate for media, to just be sure that we're making very clear what statistics we're reporting and when we're reporting them. I would add to you that another reason why I think that the reporting in general has often gotten botched in the outcomes of the election and even during the election when it came to women voters is because there was also a false presumption or assumption or hypothesis going into the election that because Hillary Clinton was a woman candidate, that of course women would vote for her, and that women in general are more likely to vote for women candidates. We know from the research that we've done for many decades here at the Center for American Women in Politics and in scholarship on women in politics more generally, that women don't simply vote for women. Just like men, the primary motivator for women's votes is party and ideology and policy. And so while Hillary Clinton may have generated a particular type of enthusiasm or engagement among women who align with her ideologically, and that was worth studying and talking about, the presumption that a Republican woman or a conservative woman who has always voted Republican would switch party allegiance just to vote for a woman candidate is false. We didn't see that in 2008 when the Republicans tried that strategy. They tried to put a woman on the ticket so that they could get some of those Hillary Clinton disaffected voters. That didn't work. Why didn't it work? Because Democratic women weren't going to switch to the Republican Party simply because there was a woman on the ballot. And so I think that narrative started the campaign with a sort of false idea and quite simply a simplification, an unfair simplification about women's voting patterns and women's and the motivation for women to vote, and then that bled through to the feigned shock that women didn't all vote for the woman candidate on election day.
Well, this, of course, this march on Women's March, largely in Washington, or as I mentioned, there's 616 sister marches around the world and around the country, as far away as Beirut, Buenos Aires, Helsinki, Paris, and Tokyo, as well as in all of the U.S. major cities. It sort of is in many ways in contrast to Donald Trump's inauguration on Friday, where he's having to, you know, sort of almost pay people to show up, and there's so many empty seats. Of course, when he first announced his run for the presidency in Trump Tower, when he insulted the Latinos, most of the audience were paid extras from a Hollywood recruiting extra company. So, but the contrast here is that as many as 400,000 women are going to show up, according to the law enforcement authorities in Washington, D.C., and that the important part about this is that the organizers of this march, they're not affiliated with any of the traditional women's organizations, the established sort of organizations, and various national progressive groups. You know, this is a loose coalition of grassroots activists for gun safety, civil rights, criminal justice reform, and pay equity. So that's encouraging. I mean, in contrast to the meeting yesterday at George Washington University of all the candidates to head up the DNC, when none of them wanted to talk about the grassroots anger out there that Bernie Sanders galvanized, it seems like at least something hopeful is happening here at the grassroots, and the women are leading the way.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the march has gone through, you know, a lot of evolution from the first sort of inclination to do it and ideas to do it to what it's turned out to be on Saturday. And I think that the organizers, which themselves have evolved, right? They've included a number of different people, advocates, activists, from different communities, both geographically, by race, by sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. That has all been intentional to ensure that you have as diverse of voices at the table in planning this and in stating the principles of the march as possible. That's created conflict. It's created some levels of, you know, discord among some folks who may not be happy with the principles they stated or who is or who isn't at the table. But I think you have to give credit to the folks who have been working on the march so diligently that they've really worked to make it as inclusive as they could in the period of time that they've had. And I think the numbers that will come out, not only in D.C., but throughout the country, demonstrate, will demonstrate that those efforts, you know, were not in vain, and that people across the country and across the world, particularly women, really appreciated that and want to stand in that unity for the time that they can. You know, I've been saying to folks that it's unity for this moment, and then it mobilizes women of all stripes to go back to the issues that they care most deeply about, to go back to their specific communities, to go back to the grassroots efforts that they've been working on and work even harder. So it's not to say this march is going to lead to, you know, these same 400,000 women working on one issue, but they hopefully it will be a sort of symbolic moment and a unifying moment for them to be energized to go back and keep fighting and keep working to preserve the equality and inclusion that women have fought for hundreds of years.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Kelly Dittmer, surely though there is a connection between Donald Trump's inauguration and this march the following day, and I'm wondering whether it's that what the subtext here is. Is it the zeitgeist? Is it to do, for example, with the Access Hollywood tape that revealed Donald Trump's, whether it revealed his true character, it certainly revealed him in an unguarded moment saying appalling things about women.
Well, I think that the election in and of itself almost reinforced or condoned some of both the language and behavior that Donald Trump put forth, and not only Donald Trump, but some of his supporters, some of the people on his campaign who had histories with sexual assault, sexual harassment, and there was sort of acceptance of that, as if it was normal or okay. When Donald Trump, was accused of sexual assault, and when the video came out, he said, it's just locker room talk, and people accepted that. And I think for women, at least for some women marching this weekend, it's a moment to say, no, that's not okay. That's not normal. We will not allow this to just sort of pass as what is acceptable behavior for our president or for any men in society, for that matter. And we will not go backwards in terms of the progress for gender equality, for women's safety, for pushing back against the misogyny that really not only got a louder voice in this campaign, but again, was allowed. And I think that to the extent that there can be any unifying message or motivation tied to the presidential election, I think that's one of them. And then I think there are very real policy concerns, many of them listed in the Women's March United principles, that were raised in this election and therefore motivate action the day after the inauguration.
Well, just to add to what you said, the confirmation hearings are underway for Donald Trump's choices for his cabinet, and there are more members of this cabinet accused of spousal abuses than there are of women.
Right, yeah. Well, right, and I think, you know, and to be able to just vocally point that out and don't let people fall into a complacency of this is normal or this is just crazy Trump politics. No, this is, you know, this is the leadership of our country, and I think women and men want to stand up and say that's not okay.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kelly Dittmer.
Sure, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kelly Dittmer. She's a professor of political science at Rutgers University and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. She's the author of Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns, as well as multiple book chapters on gender and American politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.